I am back, and I am twice as sneaky and four times as dangerous. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, the last 2 weeks I have been on vacation in my favorite foreign country, Maine. And no, I mean that literally. I think as far as the mainstream of America is concerned, Maine is truly a foreign country. Well, come on in this studio. It's all right. Just come right in here. Maine is a foreign country. Now, I don't want that to be misinterpreted. You know, I've come to some conclusions about travel, as those of you who have followed this fiasco for the last 400 years know that I'm an inveterate traveler, whatever that means. That means I like to fly the coop and split whenever I get a chance to. But it took me a long time to understand why this is so. Why traveling and getting away and getting into a completely foreign environment is as important to me personally as it is. You know, there's a quick tendency, there's a tendency on the part of every one of us to say, well, you know, you just want to get away. Well, that's not enough. What do you mean get away? Why do you want to get away? That's saying something about what you're at, you know. It really is. Oh, boy, Charles, this is great to get away. Get away from what? Well, it's too simple, really, to say, well, my work. That means probably you hate your work, which is a bad scene right there. If you're going to spend 8 hours a day for 40 years doing some cruddy thing that you hate, well, Dad, there's no 2 weeks is going to help you. That's all. It's only going to make it worse. In fact, to those of you who have that problem, I recommend don't leave, because you'll come back and one day you'll go out of the sixth floor, trying to fly. But, To a person, it's very difficult. Now, I have known in my experience people who have changed their environment. Now, that really is what getting away means, changing your environment. And when you change your environment, it's one of the great things about man that makes him different from other creatures. He is the most mobile, of the primates. He literally is. It's very difficult to get, say, an orangutan to change his range. You do, and you've got a problem orangutan on your hand. It is true. He withers and dies on the vine. It is a difficult thing to try to get, let's say, a moose to change his, environment. Oh, very difficult. They fight like mad. In fact, I'll tell you one thing I saw in Maine. In the past, this is a great difference from Sixth Avenue. And yet, in the same way, in some way, in a very subtle way, it is exactly like Sixth Avenue, somewhere in the 40s. I'm standing on this the shore of this lake, and all of a sudden I hear a little hollering, and a couple of people are saying something. I look down the lake, and there, swimming across the lake in full view of everybody, is a moose. Now, moose are not that plentiful. To be swimming across lakes in the middle of an American state at high noon, but yet here was a moose swimming across the lake, followed closely by a dog. And the two of them had probably already had put maybe a mile and a half of water behind them, and the dog was barking all the way. Now, the moose was at least 19 feet tall. He weighed probably 7.5 tons, or just a shade more than the Cadillac Eldorado. And he's even has more horsepower than the average Cadillac. He comes out of the water about a half mile away from me, tears off into the woods, and the dog, which was about 1.5 feet tall, goes off after him, yelling at the top of his idiotic lungs. Now you can see the close parallel between this situation and Sixth Avenue. I don't have to belabor the point. Nevertheless, I saw this. And I realized that life is hell even among the lesser creatures, as far as the IQ scale is concerned in the mammalian group. Now, however, if you were to go to the moose and say, well, you know, what you should do is move. I mean, it is true that this idiotic beagle has got some kind of a hang-up about moose. You should move. Well, I don't know whether the moose would move. You see, there's the problem. Man would. In the end, man goes. He'll eventually wind up on Saturn. He'll change his range to the point where he has to produce an artificial atmosphere with him as he goes. Sure. What do you think this means when you are wearing a space suit and you're in a space, some kind of a space vehicle? You're producing an artificial Earth. It's an artificial environment, just like Sixth Avenue or the Grand Concourse or Cleveland. And you take it up there and you set it down on four legs or whatever the spindle is. It'll set down on its landing pad up in Mars. And there it is. You've got your own. You brought it with you. It's like if the moose brought 7 acres of forest land and set it down somewhere in Pelham and you know, proceeded to be a moose. Well, only man can do this. Only man. And yet, strangely enough, only a few men really take advantage of this. Very few men do this. They value their environment so much, generally, that they are very afraid to make any kind of change, even though it's the limited change of moving over the face of the Earth. And for that reason, you'll find that I think this is one of the reasons why all the turnpikes, everywhere you go, have such a vast lure for the true non-travelers. The turnpike is for people who hate traveling. It really is. Because the turnpike reduces traveling to sitting in your friendly car. That's all it is. And you see nothing more than that. You could travel from New York all the way to Los Angeles and see nothing but concrete and big green signs that say toll house ahead. And you could say, yes, I remember going through Indiana. They had the sort of dark green signs. I remember them very well. They had blue glass in the turnpike, windows there. And I remember there was a tall, thin man who took the tolls there. Whereas, you know, Connecticut has automatic ones. They're way ahead of Indiana. And, so, incidentally, I'd like to point out, if I may, if the sorehead in me here, that there is a town now on the turnpike, up in Massachusetts that simply goes by the name of Toll Land. and I stopped in a Howard Johnson, of course, there, which is the capital of the town. That's where their city hall is. I stopped there. By the way, their mayor is called Texas Tommy, which is, of course, a specialty of Howard Johnson. And I stopped there, and I went into the Howard Johnson there, and I says, how do you like living in Toll Land? And the guy looked out at me, and he was wearing those sunglasses, you know, that all turnpike people wear. It's the sunglasses ubiquitous on the turnpike as that long kepi used to be among travelers across the Sahara. And it is. It's a symbol. They sell them out there. They have you ever gone into a turnpike, Howard Johnson? They have giant collections of sunglasses there of all kinds, rhinestones. They have the adventurer type, you know, that slant back and have little fins on the side and all that. You know, it's all part of the Buck Rogers world. I went into this place, you see, and I said to the guy, this is Toll Land. Yeah, the car is going past me. Yes, we pronounce it Toll Land. I said, oh, very good. And you don't pay for lunch there. You just give them the toll. And it's all part of the toll that we're all paying. By the way, toll is a great word. I suggest you look that one up. That's something that we're all paying. We'll all eventually pay it at the great toll house at the end of the road. And isn't that true? Hi, George. Keeps creeping in here, doesn't it? However, that problem of getting out of your environment so that you suddenly, when you get back, you really see your environment. And you see things which you take for granted, suddenly with a new light, and only lasts for a couple of days, and you're right back arguing with Mr. Leader again. You forget the whole scene, and you're right back where you started. So it's just a momentary euphoria of insight. So don't think that you're going to bring anything back from Italy that'll count more than 3 days. In fact, I think most travelers hate traveling. And for that reason, all over Europe and in every place that I've gone throughout pretty much of the civilized world, you'll find in every town a little place that is home, for every traveler of every persuasion. Believe me, have you noticed that all the Frenchmen that come to town here immediately rush down to these two-bit French restaurants on 49th Street and sit there and drink the same lousy wine they drink back home and come up with the same idiotic arguments about the Gaulle that they come back with in Marseille, you know? And yeah, oh yeah, we think only Americans do this. Oh boy. why, there are clubs here that do nothing but admit Englishmen. Immediately after they get off the boat, they go right to the club and they sit there with their sundowner in their hand and their cork helmet on their head and they relive it. Oh, yes, it's all there. And it's just less obvious to us, you see. It's very obvious when you go to Munich, for example. In the middle of Munich, you find a giant PX where all the Americans are hanging around drinking canned American beer. And one of the wildest examples you think I'm funny? That here you got the greatest beer in the world that flows like rivers all out of Munich, you know. And I went in with a guy into the giant PX in Munich, and he went in to buy a beer it comes in a can, see, and it's a six pack, and on the side of it, it's an American beer, it says made just like the beers in Germany. The classical German beer, and he's buying it there. They import it over there, and he drinks it down. I think it's the sound of the can opening he likes. It gives him a sense of it's another psychological problem there, too. The minute they start bringing out Leuvenbräu in cans, he might be happier. Speaking of cans, that's another hang-up. If you notice that lately on TV that they're beginning to sell bottles, only they call them the new glass cans. So that's an involved hang-up. Of course, the word can has had many, many connotations, many uses. It covers many. We're not even going to explain that to you out there in Queens. You just think about it. So it's much more somehow subtly satisfying than the word glass or bottle, as it's pronounced in certain areas of Manhattan here. So speaking of insight, I am driving along through a gigantic, insane Atlantic gale, hailstorm, whatnot, through Maine. And on either side is the primeval wilderness. They really have it there. And you see this giant spruce, this evergreen forest, and once in a while a deer comes shooting out of the woods and wildly goes to the other side and say, yeah, they're still as scared as they were the first time they saw a car, you know? Deer, they never get used to it. They have that all wild-eyed look, no matter how many times they hop across the turnpike. So I'm driving along. It's about 10 o'clock at night, maybe 11, and I have a radio, terrible radio in the car, and I turn it on, and floating through this strange howling gale is my own voice, and it's talking about Sixth Avenue, you see, and here I am, and the wind is screaming up and down the turnpike, and I see, as you always see in Maine, there's little places carved out, just a little chunk out of the woods, and here is a miserable looking shack. It's interesting. They're not the classical log cabin, you know. That if it was, you'd feel better about it. But these places look like somebody has gone around the county and collected a lot of old Pepsi-Cola signs and nailed them together, and they've gotten themselves somewhere an abandoned Oldsmobile Rocket 88. And the Oldsmobile Rocket 88 has now been dragged to the backyard, and it is slowly falling up. Yes, every one of them has in the backyard a late model car sinking into the mud. This has not changed. The only thing that's changed since my last visit in Maine is that now, instead of one car sinking in the mud in the backyard, most have two, and quite often one's a compact now sinking into the mud, which they've abandoned. So, you know, we're a two-car junk family. Speaking of junk, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York, and we'll be here till the cows come home. While we're speaking of cows, do you have the little whoopee thing in there? Speaking of cans, the thing on the list there, you got it there? You better, yeah, there you go. Yeah, just hit it. Yeah, there we go. Speaking
Hello?
Of canned beer.
Hi, honey.
Who is the ale man?
Canned virility.
He could be you, a man with a thirst for a
I think it's more depressing to find a bunch of chicks
Nine
drinking ale.
At our spot.
Three out of four men.
Of course, they all have mustaches.
Every time she's right. The bowler, keener tasting ale.
They wear high leather Russian boots, even in the summer.
There are men... And there are ale men.
Yes, that's true.
And for an ale man, there's only one ale.
That's
Ballantine.
Sad, isn't it? How limited.
Bolder, keener, more terrible. To the point. Ballantine ale. It could make an ale man out of you. What do you say?
Who is the ale man? He
could be you, a man with a thirst for a manlier brew. Three out of four
manlier brew.
Every time
that was milk,
the bolder, keener tasting ale. The bolder, keener tasting ale. Valentine.
Have you noticed that so many products today are assigning human characteristics to their product? A manlier brew. Can't you just see this little can of beer sitting there growing stubble? And, you know, going out to the ball game. A manlier brew. That's funny. Of course, psychologists have known for years that products do have a gender association. You know that there are certain cars, certain automobile names, brand names, makes, which are masculine and some are called feminine cars. That is the definite truth. They have a feminine, some kind of very subtle feminine connotation. I'm not talking about the obvious things like the color of the seat covers or the color of the car. I'm talking about the name of the automobile itself, the make. That there are certain cars that women just don't, when the man buys it, he's making a statement. speaking of making statements, I'm on my way back. I have to finish this story, and I'm coming along through the wind and the howling rain and all the jazz, and I can hear my voice, and it finally fades out, disappears completely. And there's another, by the way, another thing, too, about finding yourself recorded is that you find yourself arguing with yourself. It is indeed a terrible problem, and I would suggest that for any of you who would like to get an insight into what sort of adult you really are, just sit down for about an hour and say all the things you think into a tape recorder, and then keep it for a while, about, say, a week, and then when you're having a particularly stressful evening, turn it on and just start playing it at full blast, and you'll know why you're in trouble. It'll come through with startling clarity. You yell at yourself, you know. Well, it's even more depressing when you're 6,000 miles away. You've tried to escape your atmosphere, your environment, your zeitgeist, and it follows you all the way up in the main. And you can hear it coming in, and it finally fades out. That is the most depressing thing I know of, to find yourself fading out. You know, this is somehow it's the foretelling of things to come. You know, and you're fading out to what? Nothing. I hear some religious program is sneaking in on me. Some guy out in the Middle West is making a pitch for dough, and then he fades out, and somebody coming out with a hillbilly record, and he's selling potholders. Well, I mean, and we all came in with an equal shot up there in Maine, so there was no discrimination involved. It was purely on the basis of atmospherics, which, by the way, is also significant. I don't think nature discriminates at all. I mean, you get a bad knee, you got a bad knee. It doesn't make any difference whether you think beautiful thoughts or not. A bad knee is a bad knee. And it all works equally on all of us, every last one. Well, I'm whistling along through the dark. And all up and down throughout Maine, you see these little niches that are carved out of by today's standards, by American standards today, it is truly the wilderness. By American standards. It's not by old Maine standards any longer. Of course not. But by American standards. And in fact, are you aware that there are large sections of Maine that are still inaccessible by any form of normal transportation? That there's about a third of that state that is not inhabited at all. That if you want to get to certain places, you fly in. You just have to fly in a little plane with floats, and you fly into this lake and land, and that's about it. And that's nothing there. Howard Johnson hasn't made it. Nothing is out there yet. And there's a vast untapped area for dance halls and beer parlors and everything. Well, we'll bring it there. Don't worry. And so there are still signs, though, of America is everywhere. That's one thing that has made this country totally inexplicable to other countries is the homogeneous quality of it. That if you were to travel in Europe, and I speak, you know, this is experience. If you ever travel 200 miles in any direction in Central Europe, you've gone through at least three languages. The architecture changes, the religions change, even the looks on the people's face change as you go a couple of hundred miles, even sometimes 10 miles in one direction. So it's an eerie feeling, you know, to go across a border in Europe looks the same. You know, the trees are on one side. You go, and there's a little thing. It's just got a little fence, you know, with white and black markings. It's like one of these crossing fences at a train. You know, it's down. It says border. Achtung! And you stop. And the guy comes over with a uniform with a white braid all over, and he checks your passport. You go into the country 10 feet into the next country, and everybody's got a different look on their face. Their eyes are sort of big wide, big clunky jaws or something, and a very different crowd. And they have a completely different look. The food tastes different. You get sick a different way there. Everything is different. And it's an eerie thing. And so in Europe, of course, this is life. This is the way it is. But you can travel 3,000 miles in America and find the same knotheads all over. You just can't miss. And same thing. We're all made. What did it to? Who knows? There's a lot of things. The coaxial cable, of course, is the most obvious. That's what I was getting to. Here in this darkness, I'm riding along, and I look into this little shack, this little house stuck in the woods there. The income of this family is probably about $7 a year. Can't be any more than that. Yes, poverty is rampant in many of the far northern areas. Of course, most people are aware of that, so that's belaboring an obvious point. We keep thinking in terms of the hills, you know, it was West Virginia in this place, but wow. Up in the backwoods and in the northern areas, that poverty is a tough problem, really, among many people there. Industry is leaving. There's a lot of things about it. But here is this little shack, and I look. Of course, every little shack throughout Maine has a gigantic tower that stretches up like 100 feet in the air, and it has a 17-element Yagi beam up there. Oh yes, they've got a better element. They've got a better antenna system than most of the top radar reporting stations had during World War II, just to get the Beverly Hillbillies. Now I wonder what a real hillbilly thinks watching the Beverly Hillbillies. I mean, you know, what does he think it is? It had nothing to do with, I don't know whether you know anything about hillbillies, but there's nothing like it. I can tell you, Buddy Ebsen is not playing a hillbilly. He's playing an actor playing a hillbilly. It's a very different scene. That's different, very different. Just like almost every actor we ever see playing kings is an actor playing a king. Have you ever seen a king? You never saw a weedy or lot. I'll tell you, there isn't a Laurence Olivier in the crowd. You know, there they are. It doesn't matter. So I see in the darkness there, this little house, and I look through, and of course it's made out of Pepsi-Cola signs and Coca-Cola signs and old Ford signs and stuff. And there you can see through this little window, you can see that the flickering blue-purple light is on. And you see a couple of huddled heads there looking at this thing. They're in touch with the infinite. They're paying obeisance to whatever gods that are out there. And I really don't know what a guy who lives in the middle, there's a strange sense of unreality you get coming from the world where all that jazz originates, that comes down the pipe, down the cable, to the place where people are really living. You know, they really are having trouble. I mean, it's tough to get the bacon there. They've got real problems. You should see Saturday night. I would love to do a documentary on the kind of discontent that is going on in little towns in America. That every last chick in America, in small towns like Waterville, Maine, and so on, almost every last girl that I met in those towns, almost everyone is just waiting for that instant when she can cut out and go to New York. Are you aware of this? Has anyone done a TV show on this element? I mean, on the widespread thing, not just on a girl who wants to come to New York, I'm talking about the social discontent that exists among the girls. It's primarily women. They want to cut out. They want to go. Oh, you can't look at Debbie Reynolds for 2 straight years without feeling a terrible urge to get away from the YMCA dance on Saturday night. The American Legion Hall just doesn't do it anymore. After once you have seen, believe me, Elizabeth Taylor on TV, you just forget it. And they're almost, you can get a girl's attention immediately. This is a tip for any of you, any guy who's going up. You sit down in a joint, a restaurant, this chick comes up, and almost all the waitresses in Maine, in better restaurants, are college girls. That's one of the best jobs in Maine for a girl. Absolutely. They earn money because the tourists tip. It's like in Europe. The tourists tip. They make money. They meet interesting people. They get away from working down over the sporting goods store, working for old Doc Quimby, who pays $12 a week, and you got to clean his dentures. You know, that kind of thing. And so, that's hometown life. It really is out there. So the chicks are all waiting, the ones I saw. Now, again, I'm going to get 400 letters from angry ladies who are going to say, my daughter doesn't think that way. And, of course, the daughter's saying nothing. She's listening, you know. Well, all you got to do when the girl comes over to your table is she gives you the water, you know, and the napkin and the little thing, and you sit there for a moment. And you say, how can you stand it here? And she looks at you and says, how did you know? And then you're off, you see. You say, well, it's New York. And, of course, they've all got the dream of making the scene in the village. This seems to be the big bit. Won't it be fantastic when all of New Hampshire moves to the village? And all of the village has got an insane desire to go to New Hampshire and emulate Salinger and write the novel. And all of New Hampshire is populated by village hippies. And the entire village is taken over by bucolic types from Oakland, Maine. And they run into nothing but Oakland, Maine types, you know, running in and out of the Rienzi and the tourist joints downtown. So the thing, I'm beginning to be aware of this great discontent that exists. It's an unbelievable discontent. And then the worship on television almost has gone into another dimension. It really is becoming something almost like one of the more esoteric oriental religions. It's a transcendentalism. They are transcending their environment completely. In short, sitting in front of the tube is a moment of satori, insight. It is a moment of turning your guts inside out and getting away from Doc Quimby. And you're in touch with David Susskind, where people think, you know. Well, you know, that's comparatively speaking, of course. And it is a real hang up out there. And so you go along and you'll see places that'll say the Beverly Hillbillies Lobster Pound. They name things after TV shows now. That's true. It's terrible to name your big swinging restaurant after a TV show that goes off the air, you know, like the Medic Cocktail Lounge. And it's been off for about 6 months, you know, and you have little sutures and things that decorate the walls. It's a lot of interesting ideas. You know, you can serve your drinks in little beakers and the hypodermic needles, you know, you can put the vermouth in. Oh, I got ideas. You know, you wear Ben Casey type doctor clothes with a bartender, and he says, I'll make an analysis of you. He says, let's see, I'll make, the prescription is 2 martinis, and he lays it out there. Well, I want to say this, though, going even further about Maine and the coming back, of course, is always a problem. You come back because you see everything anew. You do, briefly. And you see how unreal most of the things that are being done on the air about America are. You really do. For just that brief moment, you hear people being interviewed all day long who have written plays, who have done movies, and it has no relationship at all, none whatsoever, none at all, with the life lived by a guy in Oakland, Maine. None of the stuff they're writing, doing, saying, anything. Nothing. What is it? It's become a separate entity in our world, this whole business of showbiz, writing, the whole jazz. And you find, as you get out there, that the great problems that surge through the minds of everybody up and down McDougal Street and over at the YMHA up on 92nd Street has not even touched anybody. That's why it doesn't even extend. I'll tell you, the influence doesn't extend 20 feet the other side of the Hudson. You begin to lose it about West Morris, New Jersey. You do, it begins to fade out. It's like there's a big boil going here, and it's New York. It's, you know, the big thing, wild thing. And, of course, it's as though everybody 10 million miles out is plugged into it. And they watch it for an hour every night. It's like watching some kind of a snake or And if, for a while, oh, really, you know, you go to Coney Island. You really do. You know, it's like giving yourself up. You know, when you go to Coney Island and you ride on the merry-go-rounds and all that stuff, it's an obvious respite from reality and life. Well, that's what television is to people out there where life is going on. I mean, life that is just life. It's lived as normally, and when I say lived, it is unselfconscious. Life in New York is exceedingly self-conscious. So it's not lived, it's observed. It's a different thing. you watch a rabbit. Is a rabbit living or what? You know, he's just living. He walks around and eats and scratches and does all the stuff. You know what rabbits do. Terrible things. And he fools around and he doesn't write about them. He doesn't pull a D.H. Lawrence about the last rabbit he met. He doesn't write a big thing, Lady Chatterley in the Bushes, nothing to this. He just goes about his business, does it, walks around, it scratches, and that's the end of it. Well, that's the way they are in Oakland, Maine. You know, they don't worry about it. There's no hang up. I mean, you know, there's the front porch, and life is life, you know, and there are the bushes, and that's the way it is. Really, it's a very strange difference, but a very important one. So a guy sitting out in Oakland, Maine will say, watching, let us say, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf going on, which is a typical example of New York at its best. Everybody's scratching and yelling and hollering. And they're all sitting. I can just see six Maineites sitting there watching this, trying to figure out what they're talking. What's the matter? What's bugging them? And it is very hard to understand what is bugging them unless you're right here and in it. If you are here and in it, then you know. It's like we have a secret thing going here in New York. And we all understand it, and we do. We respond to it. Very difficult for a guy living just outside of Presque Isle. Can't you just see old Carl and Mamie? For 47 years, they've been living on the shores of Snowshoe Pond, which has 107 inches of ice beginning in September. You know, and the ice goes out about the third week in August. And you know, you can hear the wailing of the wind out there, and an occasional great snowy horned owl whistles past, and they're watching Virginia Woolf. It's a very different world, and it is out there. It is out there. Don't put it down and say I'm inventing it. It is there. For you writers who are interested, it really is there. And sure, if a guy goes up to Provincetown for 2 weeks, he figures he's seeing the provinces. You know, this is the writer's way of getting out with nature. But I'm talking about out there way back of Bar Harbor. I'm talking out there where, believe me, a big sign that says Pepsi-Cola for those that think young is a total enigma. They can't figure it out, you know. They're just like, think young, you know. And there's a 6-year-old kid walking around with a straw hat on his head and a pair of overalls, and an 87-year-old guy walking around with a straw hat and a pair of overalls, and they're both chewing the same bubble gum. And the sound says, you know, scientists think young. Who are you talking about? And they walk around. Well, Saturday night, let me tell you a little scene. The discontent, though, is becoming evident. It's just like the discontent, the terrible discontent that is felt by peasants everywhere, simple people who have somehow glimpsed some kind of strange right that's being held off in the distance. You find this true in outlying districts in Italy, for example. There is a great discontent often about wanting to get to Rome and be part of some big ceremony, some big thing that's happening in the Vatican. It is a religious thing, you say. It really is. It's a terrible discontent to get there and go and make the pilgrimage and come back. Go to Mecca. And everyone today wants to go to New York to make the pilgrimage, to go to Mecca. And if possible, take up residence in Mecca. Somehow get the ordained or something and stay here. And become one of the acolytes or something here and stay and get involved. Be one of those people that yells at other people. Virginia, we'll be one of those people with a hang-up. A lot of guys are working actively in places like Cleveland on a hang-up. It's not easy to develop a hang-up. You know, everyone thinks they just come naturally. But believe me, there are guys you can buy even books on it. You can buy little handbooks. Yes! They're sold. It says, are you uncomplicated? There is such a book that you can buy. Are you uncomplicated? Have you found that you're dull? Have you found that people are not interested because you're not neurotic? That you're not nervous? That nothing makes you jump? Have you found that you dig chicks? There's no problem at all. Well, you can take a correspondence course and hang up, and then you can come back and become a satirist. Make big dough. But that's another problem. Now, by the way, do you know that there is an outfit that is giving now correspondence courses in satire? And one of the saddest things I have, I'll tell you, how I ever got on the mailing list, I don't know. It just happened. Somebody sends me every week. Apparently, they're trying to get me to subscribe. It's a scary thing. Every week, you know that there is a service now that provides topical comments on topical world themes for topical comics on every given category. You get and it comes every week, and it's based on the headlines of that week. And what is really scary is to read some of this junk, and the next day, some comic, I'll get this thing to me, sent to me, you see, it's only sent to professional comics. And the next day, Jack Gould or somebody in the Times will say, you know, old Charlie the satirist made a fantastically beautiful insight remark last night on the Ed Sullivan Show when he said blah, 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 whoopee, whoopee, cigarette smoking. Wow, Laos, Mao Zedong. And that I read on the service, you know, it came in this little two-bit mimeograph service from out in Queens somewhere or someplace, wherever it's turned out. This is true. And you know that many, I have seen comics, I have seen guys, I have seen, what is even more sickening, I have seen comics who are working in racial themes use this thing and get applauded for their great insight. And of course, it's coming off the line, it's coming off of a ditto machine just as much as, have you ever seen in the back of Popular Mechanics and that where it says, 100 stories? Guaranteed laugh getters, L-A-F-F. Laughs for all occasions, for speakers, for... Well, that's what's going on now in the world of satire. You can buy this. You can get the service. And if you, and it's all based on... And oh, by the way, they can be read either way. They can either be liberal comments or conservative comments, depending on the audience that you're involved in. And there'll be 8 takeoffs on Adlai Stevenson and 7 takeoffs on Barry Goldwater. You can just take which one, you know, whatever you want. Speaking of, do we have the West thing in there? Speaking of Barry Goldwater, hit that thing in there.
The most spectacular epic in American history explodes across the screen. Now, MGM and Cinerama present How the West Was Won.
Poor Nixon still trying to figure it out.
How the West Was Won. Directed by Henry Hathaway, John Ford, and George Marshall, with a cast of over 12,
you know what happened to him,
including
in the primaries,
24 of Hollywood's greatest stars: James Stewart, Henry Fonda, Debbie Reynolds, Robert Preston, Carol Baker, John Wayne, Richard Whitmark, George Papar, Carolyn Jones, Eli Wallach, Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb, Gregory Peck, narrated by Spencer Tracy.
And born pioneer.
How the West Was Won, filmed in glorious Metrocolor.
Princeton,
winner of the Photoplay Award for Best Picture of the Year and 3 Academy Awards for its spectacular sound, editing, and original
spectacular
screenplay.
Sound. They won an award for spectacular sound? You mean they give awards now for just sound? Not soundtrack or dialogue, just spectacular sound. Well, World War II wins an award for spectacular noises. Let's see here. We don't miss the How the West Was Won, a showcase presentation now showing at especially selected theaters throughout greater New York. They combed them with a fine-tooth comb. They weeded out the sore heads. And special selection there. Imagine them sitting around saying, well, let's see. Debbie goes over great. Let's Fordham Road. On the subject, though, of this problem, is this thing, the homogeneity of our world, and the relationship of, you know, I meant to do something tonight, which I never did get around to do it. That's what happens when you go away. You come back with too many things to say. But I want to describe a scene that I ran into in a little town, in Maine, central Maine, north central Maine. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was a Saturday night. It was actually Sunday morning, and they have a law there. And the law is a law about the sale of liquor on Sunday. Well, this is just no liquor sold after, I think it's 1 o'clock or something like that, 1 a.m. And now they have state liquor stores throughout Maine. But this is beer I'm talking about. You cannot sell beer in a grocery store, wherever beer is sold, after 1 o'clock. Well, Monday they were having an election there in Maine. And by the way, it's fantastic to listen on the radio and hear a guy giving election returns. And it'll say, Charles A. Quimby, running for state assemblyman from the 23rd district, now has 6 votes for Charles L. Watson, running for the same office, has 3 votes. Albert Murphy has 1. So Charles L. Quimby wins. And you can imagine this little town with 8 guys. Isn't it terrible to know that 3 of your friends have voted against you? Oh, let me tell you, the hatreds are long and deep and lasting, and that kind of a, that's true democracy in action. But this little tableau, which I come from a town, I've spent time, a lot of time in small towns in the Midwest, so I know something about small town life. And I want to describe a scene that the likes of which I've never seen in my life. I went into this place. All over Maine, you know, they have places where they sell pizza. Pizza pie is a big thing in Maine. It's even bigger in Maine than it is in Jersey, if you can believe it. But they're real pizzas. They're not frozen ones. Real ones. Fantastic. And they serve, everywhere you go, they serve or sell Italian sandwiches. They call them about 19 different things. Submarines, torpedoes, bombs, everything up there. And some of them really are, I'll tell you, your ears burn and everything. But they all weigh about 8.5 pounds up there. But I went into this place at 1 o'clock. It's a little tiny place. It's about 6 square feet. And 2 guys are wildly making pizzas, and they're wildly making Italian sandwiches. And out in front, all the local males, the disgruntled local males have arrived in their 46 Mercuries, in their 51 Hudsons, you know, and they're all out there, and they've got stuff painted all over the side of them. And they're pouring into this place to buy beer. Guys are buying beer. Give me $5 of beer. They're piling the beer on. And in 3 minutes, it's going to close. No more beer. But this is the thing that I couldn't believe. At least, I would say, out of 10 guys that came in, right down, I never saw such insane drunkenness in my life. Insanely pie-eyed. It was like the whole town was drunk. And they were all coming in, wandering in and out of the streets, yelling and hollering and buying the beer. And nowhere could you see a woman. It was just a whole lot of men coming in to buy beer to as fast as they could. And of course, they were turning out and the guy had one eye on the watch as he was making these. And finally, he says, "No, I'm sorry. It's too late." And one guy had 2 cases of beer in his hand. He says, "I'm sorry, Charlie, I can't take your money." And he takes the beer right away from him, throws it back in the icebox, and the guy's crying. He's standing there, you know, he can see the whole weekend. He's not going to be drunk. What am I going to do the whole weekend? And I wonder when anyone is going to do a real documentary on the peculiar kind of discontent that is settling in on the small towns in America because of the glimpse. I think it's because of the glimpse they see every night of this never-never land that David Susskind lives in. You know, that land where people sit and talk to Sidney Poitier and they're very concerned. It's a wild, wild sense of unreality that's beginning to take over. And the stores in these places all have a vaguely TV commercial look about them. Oh, yes, you see endorsements by Buddy Ebsen every place you look. Endorsements by Ben Casey. Ben Casey's endorsing lawnmowers, the whole scene, you know. If you're going to amputate your toes, do it with a Ben Casey. You know, that kind of thing. And they live in a world that is bounded on one side by Channel 8 and then the other side by Channel 6. And everywhere you can see in those hemlock trees are those long, tall, thin antennas reaching for Parnassus.